ever existed. And in fact, someone has said that we have so much knowledge that we are plagued with info-obesity. Right? We are plagued with info-obesity. And that, I believe that to be true. We have tons of information, lots of knowledge. If you've got medical symptoms, what do? WebMD, right? Check out WebMD, and you just look up your medical system. I've got this, this, and this going on. I'm like, oh, I have ovarian cancer. Great. Wait, that's not possible for me, by the way. But I've been convinced before that I have it because of WebMD. That's what we do. We can go online and find anything we want. You want to find the best restaurant? Go to Google Maps. Find the best restaurant. Before, you had to have that savvy, right? You had to have been to all the restaurants to know which restaurant is best. So you have all these things. You want to learn how to wrestle an alligator in a Subway? Go to YouTube. You can find that. So there's so many. It's the information's right there at our fingertips. So my question is, with all of that, and I don't think Google or YouTube can answer this question, how, with all of this info and knowledge, have we become dumber? We have. I believe we have. We are all supposed to be smarter because of all this, but our decisions, our life choices, they don't seem to be reflecting this in any way, shape, or form. Sure, we have crazy advances in technology, but we can't get along. We know so much about the universe, but we're doing much worse when it comes to understanding how to live in it. We're doing much worse in understanding how to allow others to live in it. We're not doing so great. We're smart, but are we? Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, "The best part of our knowledge is that which teaches us where knowledge leaves off and ignorance begins." I don't think people realize where that line is. I think it's part of our problem. Part of our problem, the biggest part of our problem, is probably that we are know-it-alls. If you don't believe me, go to any Facebook chat on politics. Watch them fight it out. We are a bunch of know-it-alls. And that leaves us no room to listen. Being a know-it-all leaves me no room to listen. It leaves me no room to learn. Now, if your response to that statement is, yeah, those people who know it all are especially annoying to those of us who do. If that's your response to that statement, then the word may not penetrate this morning. Where do we most often go wrong? With the knowledge that we possess. It's great to know, but what good is it if you should have known better? Right? It's good to know something, but what good is it if you always should have known better? Can we go forward on the slides, gentlemen? I didn't pick up the thing. Thank you. You guys recognize him? I guess so. That's somebody you know. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 and 2. Now concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Verse 2. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. So Paul, in his discussion to the Corinthians, he says that this knowledge, and incidentally, you see in most of your Bibles, you're going to see that all of us possess knowledge is in quotations. It's believed by most scholars that this was a quote from the letter that they wrote to Paul,
or to some communication that Paul received from them, that this is something that they claimed. We have knowledge. And Paul takes that and says, okay, you're smart. I have some things to talk to you about concerning that. He says that this knowledge that you have puffs up. It means to inflate. And this knowledge, this word puffs up in the original, it means, of course, to inflate, but it means that it has no structure. It only is an appearance of strength. Okay? Why does the puffer fish do this? There are other animals in the animal kingdom that do this. Right? Why does this happen? Well, to give an appearance of strength. It's a defense mechanism. They're actually quite small, right? So they get puffed up in order to show that they're strong, in order to show that they're formidable, in order to show that they are so great. Don't bite me, I'm big. And look at my terrible spines, right? But the pufferfish, they don't have any ribs. They don't have a pelvis. They don't have any pectoral fins. And so they're able to do this to themselves. They have no structure. They have no actual innards at all. And the only thing that really makes a pufferfish formidable is that they're the most toxic vertebrates on the planet. Some of the most. So when you eat them, that can be a problem. We have the pufferfish. Paul says that this knowledge puffs up. But what does he mean by that? All right, guys, you can go forward. Pufferfish is a distraction now. So what did Paul mean when he said that this knowledge puffed up? What knowledge is he talking about? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. First, we have to notice the contrast. Knowledge puffs up, but love, watch, builds up. This word builds up means to found. And not to find as if you're searching for it, but as in a foundry or a foundation. This love builds up. It increases the size of something, but it does so with structural integrity. Jesus uses the same word in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. Upon this rock I will build my church. Something with structural integrity. And so knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And that's what we are looking for. So this context that we have, and I'm thankful to Nathan for reading it for us in our scripture reading this morning. We have Paul talking about this idea of meat offered to idols. Not something that we experience today. Right? We don't have a temple with idols in it and meat being offered from that temple for people to eat. Are there things that we can equate to it? Well, maybe so, but this was definitely a cultural thing that was going on. And so they had some wrestling with it. There were some struggles as to whether to eat this meat or not. Eat this particular meat. The issue was that there were some who obviously had no issue with eating an animal that had been used as a sacrifice in pagan worship because they knew, here's the word, they know that idols were fake gods. They weren't real. And so the sacrifices actually meant nothing. That was something that was true. That was not, Paul never says in this context, like, hey, you're wrong about that. He acknowledges that their knowledge was true, founded knowledge. So it's not as if he's saying, hey, the knowledge that you proclaim to have, that isn't real knowledge. I have to tell you different. Not saying that. He's about to tell them what to do with said knowledge. Because of this, because these gods, they knew that these gods were fake. They weren't real. Because of this, the meat wasn't actually tainted or unholy, and it was good to eat. And again, Paul agrees with that. Now, the problem is that some did not have this knowledge. There were people in their congregation, there were people in their fellowship that did not have this knowledge, that an idol was nothing. So here it gets kind of interesting. So because of their backgrounds in paganism, likely, never underestimate the power of upbringing, by the way. Because of their backgrounds in paganism, they were not yet able to deny the existence of these gods. Okay? Some of these Christians were not yet able to deny the existence of these gods. Now, they had renounced them, and they have confessed that Jesus is Lord over them. He had become their king instead of these gods. But they still hadn't got to the point in their walk, in their very young Christian faith, to be able to renounce these gods that they had, or to deny their existence. They hadn't got to the point where they were able to deny their existence. So while they were still growing and learning and being sanctified, their part of their growth was to let go of their former faith walk, if you will. All right? And so this is important to understanding this context. These people, there were people among them that still held on to their former beliefs. I don't know if you've ever... I'm trying to think of the book. I lost it now. That's what I get for not putting it down in my notes. What? No. Thank you. That's where we're at. But there was a book written, maybe it'll come to me a minute ago, in a moment, about some missionaries that went over, and in their attempt to convert all of these people that had never heard of Christ, they converted. They were successful in the conversion, but it took years to convince these people that the gods that they formerly served were not actually real. They still feared them. Eternity in their hearts. There, I got it out. Anybody ever recognize that book? Heard of that book before? Eternity in their hearts? Go and check that out. But in that book, it highlights the difficulty, not in converting these people to Christ, but the difficulty of eradicating those idols out of their psyche. Okay? It was difficult to do. The same similar thing is happening here. That there's years of upbringing and years of teaching of idol teaching. It must have been a prominent thing because there were actual temples dedicated to these idols. And so these are the type of people that Paul says that they are dealing with. Their conscience, Paul says, could not handle partaking of the meat or sitting in a temple to honor those idols. Like they were converted to Christ. They no longer could partake in those particular things, else their conscience would be harmed. So notice what Paul tells them in verse 7. He says, however, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. They don't know quite yet. They don't understand that an idol is nothing. They don't have that knowledge. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat and do better and no better off if we do, Paul says. The food's not the issue. The knowledge is not the issue. Continue to listen. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. So Paul, as he often does and as Jesus often did, he takes the focus off of them and he says, how does this affect your brother? Hey, does that make sense? Right here, he switches that. He moves the conversation from, okay, here's what you know. Now, how does what you know affect who you know? Okay? How does what you know affect who you know? So he tells them that their knowledge and freedom could be a detriment, could actually end up being a detriment to their brothers and sisters. It is not appropriate to say, oh, they'll learn eventually. I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to eat this meat. They'll get there. Or to go and to put your arm around them and say, oh, it's all right, buddy. I know you don't get it now, but you will soon. Imagine that attitude. That's the attitude that Paul's trying to attack here. That you can't tell these people, oh, they should know better, and then continue to live as you always wanted to live. This wasn't, and this is important, this wasn't a choice for them.
They couldn't just easily say, okay, you're right, the idol is nothing. They had a conscience issue with this that they were still trying to deal with. 1 Corinthians 8 is a specific situation. The weak ones are truly weak. And they are young in the faith and are convinced in their hearts that eating this meat in an idol, in a temple for idols is a sin against God. Notice that it is their conscience that is weak, which means that their destruction comes about by partaking of the thing, not just seeing a person in an idol's temple. Okay, get that? It's not just as if this person who has a weak conscience, like, oh, I saw Paul in an idol's temple, and allowing that person. It was the person seeing and then acting based on what he saw, and it was the partaking that was the defilement of his conscience. That said, this passage doesn't give others the right to hold their scruples over you. And this is a whole other discussion. But this passage does not give anyone the right to hold their scruples over you. I call the scruple people the professional weaker brethren. All right? Yeah, the professional weaker brethren. And I'll give you an example. You are about to go home. You're about to make some homemade vanilla. All right? Anybody know what it takes to make homemade vanilla? Bottle of vodka, maybe. So you go into the store and you buy a bottle of vodka in order to make your homemade vanilla, and you come out and Sister Bertha, better than you, sees you do that, right? She sees you do that and she goes and tells everybody at the church, we need to light Denise on fire because she went in, and I don't know if you make homemade vanilla or not. Or Rebecca or Connie or whoever, we need to burn her down because well I saw her with a bottle of vodka, and that can only mean one thing. Jennifer's an alcoholic. Okay? That's not what this verse is saying, okay? That's not what this verse is saying. This passage doesn't give others the right to hold their scruples over you. Now, the true meaning of the passage also doesn't give us carte blanche to partake in anything that we want to partake whenever we want, wherever we want. All right? We have to get the full meaning of this. The illustration would follow more if you went to church with this young person who was converted after study and after being impressed with by the brothers and the love of the brothers here. This young person is converted. But this young person grew up in a household where alcohol was abused. And then he sees you in a bar sipping on some whiskey. And then he decides, well, it's okay for him. It must be okay for me. Now, that may not follow exactly. But if after he partakes, that destroys his conscience, and he ends up going down the same path that he was trying to avoid from his own household, friends, I have to believe that I took some part in that. Okay? You see the difference between the two illustrations? I hope so. What I'm trying to do is to allow us to, first of all, not abuse the passage, but at the same time to take some responsibility to say, you know what? As Paul said in the final verse, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat. Even to that point, lest I make my brothers stumble. Because you know what? It's not worth it. My freedom is not worth the sacrifice of my brother's soul. Now again, I'm not interested in catering to the professional weaker brethren, right? To Sister Bertha. There's no Berthas in here today, right? I'm not interested in catering to them. What I am interested in is the soul of my brother who may have a weak conscience because of a previous life that he lived, or because of he's got an early growth process in his Christian walk, and I need to be sensitive to that. Okay? I hope that makes sense. Knowledge can be harmful. What we know can turn out to be a detriment in some ways. We have to avoid the got it all right mentality, which becomes eventually the get them told mentality, by the way. You know that, right? I got it all right, and eventually becomes get them told. You know that? Being a knowledgeable Christian is more than just learning and memorizing and defending facts. Knowing is important. Understand, it's not the knowing that is wrong, friends. In fact, the Bible tells us to pursue knowledge. It's not the knowing that is wrong. It's the pride of knowing that makes us dumb. Right? We get blinded by all the knowledge and say, well, I am right and that's all that matters. Well, why are you doing that? It's causing your brother to stumble. If you come back with, because I can, something's wrong. Something's wrong. So, we need to know truth. We need to not just know it, but express it. How do I express my knowledge? How can I express and exercise my freedoms in Christ? And who do I know, and when do I know when to speak the truth boldly? Because that's something I'm also required to do. Rule number one, when I'm ready to deliver knowledge, when I am ready to speak the truth, Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, in love, when I'm ready to do that, first rule, you don't know everything, only God does. Right? I rarely read from the Message. In fact, I've been in all the sermons I've preached, I don't think I've ever done that. But I really loved the Message in the first few verses here in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, the first few verses. It reads this way. The question keeps coming up regarding meat that has been offered up to an idol. Should you attend meals where such meat is served or not? We sometimes tend to think we know all we need to know to answer these kinds of questions. But sometimes our humble hearts can help us more than our proud minds. We never really know enough until we recognize that God alone knows it all. Get that? I love that. We never really know enough until we understand and recognize that God alone knows it all. If I can come to grips with that fact, it will cause me to tread lightly, not rush into proclaiming. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7 is wonderful. It says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Run that back in your brain. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. That means before knowing anything, I better fear God first. And everything that I know should run through that filter. Right? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and fools despise wisdom and instruction. And so when it's time for me to deliver knowledge, when it's time for me to speak the truth loudly, boldly, and in love, I have to ask these questions first. Number one, what are my intentions? What are my intentions behind expressing the knowledge that I have? Is it to be right? Is it to get them told? When I'm in an argument or a debate with someone, is it based on, well, I just need to be right about this? And friends, I'm as guilty as anyone about this. I get lost in it, in fact, to where I know that I'm right, and so I just keep on fighting tooth and nail, and what happens is that the voices escalate, blood pressure goes up, and finally and eventually I lose all sight of to why I'm arguing in the first place. So what is the intention behind your sharing of knowledge? What do I hope to gain by it? Question number two. What do you hope to gain by sharing your knowledge? Is it so that people will know how smart you are? Right? Is your expression of knowledge, much like the Corinthians here, was it just to show everyone that you could? Why are you doing that? Well, because I can. I can exercise my freedom. What do I hope to gain? Question number three, who benefits from this knowledge sharing? Is it only me? The person I'm sharing it with benefit at all? What's the purpose? And finally, question number four, have I weighed my knowledge in the balance of heavenly wisdom? I'm going to go over to James chapter 3. Have I weighed my knowledge in the balance of heavenly wisdom? Excuse me. In James 3, verse 13, beginning, it says, who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have a bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be a disorder of every vile practice. Man, this describes why we are so dumb. We're smart, but we don't know how to apply any of it. We're unwilling. But then in verse 17, James finishes and says, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Have I weighed my knowledge in the balance of heavenly wisdom? What's my purpose in sharing it? Andy Capp. Anybody know that sage? Most famous of philosophers, Andy Capp. Some of you are giggling, you know who I'm talking about. The old comic strip, Andy Capp. Like Shane's ending his sermon with an Andy Capp quote. He said this in one of his strips. It said, I've learned one thing. People who know the least anyways seem to know the loudest. Do you find that to be true? Right? The know-it-alls. And I pray I don't want to be one of those people that may know, but as Paul says in verse 1, all of us possess knowledge, but this knowledge puffs up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. Verse 2. If you think you know, stop. Stop and breathe it in just for a moment. Take a moment. Because he who thinks he knows may not know as he ought to know. The loud knowers, facts, the loud knowers don't know God. A loud knower isn't interested in the soul of his brother. Somebody said people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. A loud knower isn't interested in the soul of his brother. He's just interested in being right. He's just interested in being able to do whatever he wants to do. One final quote. I don't know who said it, but somebody said, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Heard that before? It's not what you know, it's who you know. That is no more true for anyone than it is for a Christian. It's not what you know, it's who you know. It's not about knowing Paul as an elder. It's not about knowing Shane as the preacher. Because if I don't know Christ, what I know is rubbish. It's not going to amount to anything. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And before spouting all the things about what you know, you better know him. And you better know how he would react, and how he would love, and how he would walk, and how he would forgive and have patience and mercy and all those things. You better know that first. If you have a need this morning, pray that you would come as we stand and sing together.